A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a heavy one. He says he's got this nagging feeling we're walking into an era of mass impoverishment. Not destitution, not starvation. He's careful about that. But the systematic wiping out of the middle class. He points to three things, combining in a way that feels genuinely new. A housing market that's locked out young families almost completely, the rising cost of basic food, and salaries that haven't meaningfully grown in decades. His question is whether this convergence is driving the surge in nationalist politics, whether capitalism itself is the engine behind it, and whether we're headed for some kind of planetary social collapse. There's a lot to unpack here. He's asking whether we're headed for planetary social collapse, what levers might still exist to reverse the trajectory, and whether capitalism itself is the root cause. So let's treat this as a systems analysis, not a rant, a diagnostic.
We're sitting in June of 2026, and this is the first full year where elevated interest rates, sticky food prices, and real wage declines in 14 of 20 G20 nations have all hit simultaneously. This isn't a recession story. It's a structural squeeze. That buffer is what separates being working class from being middle class, and it's exactly what's being hollowed out.
Median household purchasing power has dropped 12% in real terms since 2021 in the US, the UK, and Canada. That's not a blip. When those stabilizers disappear, you're not middle class anymore. You're precarious, even if your income number looks okay on paper.
That's a 20-year structural trend, not post-pandemic noise. In Canada, the UK, Australia, increasingly the US. A 30-year-old today earning median income, doing everything right, cannot replicate their parents' trajectory. Not because they're lazy, not because of avocado toast. The math simply doesn't close.
The question is whether this is a cyclical downturn or a structural reconfiguration of how value is distributed. And I think the prompt's intuition is right. It's structural. These aren't temporary shocks. They're the downstream effects of specific policy choices made over 40 years.
Let's start with the math. I want to walk through the three pressure points because the numbers tell a story that's more precise than the feeling. In 1975, the median home price in Toronto was 3.5 times median household income. By 2025, that ratio had hit 12.4 times, which raises the central question. Is this a policy failure, or is it a systemic feature of late-stage capitalism where capital returns consistently outpace labor returns? Because if it's the former, we can fix it. If it's the latter, we have a much deeper problem.
Let's start with housing, because that's where the structural change is most dramatic and most measurable. The user mentions intergenerational wealth transfer and the property ladder, and those two things are directly connected.
The mechanism is worth understanding. Homeownership became the primary wealth-building vehicle for the middle class through very deliberate post-World War II policy. The GI Bill, the mortgage interest deduction, the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. These were American innovations that spread to other advanced economies. The idea was, you buy a house, you pay it off over 30 years, and by retirement, you own an asset worth several times your annual income. That asset funds your retirement, helps your kids through college, and gets passed down.
In 1985, a median income household could afford 68% of homes in their metro area. By 2025, that figure is 23%. That's National Association of Realtors data. The ladder has been pulled up. Capital flows in, prices rise. More capital flows in because prices are rising, and the people who actually need shelter are competing with institutional balance sheets. They lose every time.
And then central banks raised rates to fight inflation, and we've been sitting at 4-5% in the US and EU ever since. So you've got the double whammy of higher prices and higher borrowing costs. The report specifically calls out housing cost burdens in high-income countries as a driver of political instability.
Monthly payment, about $1,800. Same household in 2026. They've gotten 4% annual raises, so they're at $135,000.
The FAO Food Price Index shows global food prices have risen 35% cumulatively since 2020, and that's an aggregate. Specific categories are worse: grains, dairy, oils. But here's the thing about food inflation that doesn't get enough attention. It's the most regressive tax imaginable. The bottom quintile of earners in the U.S. spends about 30% of their income on food. That's a household doing everything right. Two incomes, steady raises, living in a mid-sized city, not splurging. They're treading water at best.
Now, there's a misconception worth addressing here. When people talk about the housing crisis, they often point to foreign buyers or Airbnb as the villains. But foreign buyers account for less than 5% of U.S. home purchases. That's NAR 2025 data. Airbnb listings are 1 to 2% of housing stock in most cities. The primary driver is a structural undersupply of about 3.8 million homes in the U.S., according to Zillow's 2025 estimate, and that undersupply is caused by zoning restrictions and construction labor shortages.
Zoning is the silent killer here. Most residential land in American cities is zoned exclusively for single-family homes. You can't build a duplex, a triplex, a small apartment building, the things that used to be starter homes for previous generations. And the construction labor shortage is real. We lost about 600,000 construction workers after the 2008 crash, and they never came back. So even where zoning allows building, we can't build fast enough.
Houston, Tokyo, and Auckland all relaxed their zoning in different ways, and all three saw housing affordability improve relative to their peers.
I mean, yes, that's exactly what we've optimized for. And then we're shocked when a shock breaks things. So we've got housing stripping wealth from the bottom and middle, food prices acting as a regressive tax. Now the third piece, wages.
This is the one that should make people furious. Since 1973, U.S. productivity has grown about 80%. Real median hourly compensation. The worker is producing nearly twice as much value and getting to keep almost none of the increase.
The Economic Policy Institute has been tracking this for decades. The gap isn't a mystery. It's a policy choice. Union density in the U.S. private sector went from about 30% in the 1950s to 6% in 2024. Now, let's talk about the second leg, food prices. This one doesn't get enough attention because headline inflation has moderated to around 3% in most OECD countries.
This is where the prompt's framing is so useful, because housing, food, and wages aren't three separate problems. That's on top of the increases from 2022 and 2023. It's not that food prices are spiking again. It's that they spiked and never came back down. The new baseline is permanently higher.
The mechanism here is structural, not cyclical. Fertilizer prices are up 250% since 2020. That's an input cost that works its way through the entire food supply chain. Energy for transportation and processing is more expensive. Agricultural labor shortages are persistent across advanced economies. These aren't the kinds of costs that fall when the central bank raises rates.
Then people look around and say, "Why does everything feel broken?" Because the deal changed. The post-war compact, work hard, buy a house, retire with dignity, was dismantled piece by piece, and nobody held a vote on it.
We've got this triple squeeze. Housing, food, wages, all compressing the middle class from different directions. But here's where it gets really interesting. The political response to that squeeze is making it worse. Let's trace that feedback loop.
The auto dealers struggle. The tourism industry contracts. It's a deflationary spiral in the non-essential sectors, while the essentials keep getting more expensive. Perceived scarcity activates threat-based voting. This isn't speculation. It's a well-documented causal mechanism.
Look at the 2024 European Parliament elections. Far-right parties gained in every single country with above-average housing cost to income ratios. Not correlation, it's a causal chain. Real median wage growth in the U.S. has been 0.3% annually since 2000, adjusted for inflation. Over the same period, productivity growth has averaged 2.1% annually.
Then the paradox. These parties, once in power, implement exactly the policies that created the precarity in the first place. Tax cuts for capital, deregulation of housing markets, austerity for social programs. Workers are producing more value, but the value is flowing to shareholders, not to them. That's not a market failure. That's a market working exactly as designed by the policy choices we've made.
There's another misconception to address here. You'll hear people say wages are actually growing if you look at the right metrics. And it's true that nominal wages have grown, especially during the so-called Great Resignation. But real median weekly earnings for full-time workers are up only 1.2% since 2019, according to the BLS. And those wage gains were concentrated in low-wage sectors, restaurants, retail, warehousing.
Covering the covers.
And it's happening everywhere in different flavors. The strongman playbook is consistent: identify a threat, consolidate power, redirect resources upward, blame the next threat. The economic base keeps eroding, but the political narrative keeps the base mobilized against the wrong targets.
You can't build equity without a house. You can't retire without equity. You're trapped. At what point does this become a death spiral?
That's the question the prompt is really asking. Are we headed for planetary social collapse? The mechanism is well studied, and it's not just economic. It's status anxiety. The middle class isn't afraid of becoming destitute. They're afraid of falling into the working class.
Let's talk about the intergenerational wealth transfer, because I think the prompt's intuition about a natural expiration date is correct, and it's one of the most under-discussed dynamics in this whole picture.
Here's the math. The baby boomer generation holds an enormous amount of housing wealth, trillions of dollars in the U.S. alone, concentrated in coastal cities where prices have appreciated the most. As they age and die, that wealth transfers to their children. This is already happening. It's why you see 35-year-olds buying million-dollar homes. They're not doing it on salary. The data from the 2024 election cycle updates this in a way that's hard to ignore. Counties where real wages declined by more than 5% since 2020 shifted an average of 8 points toward populist candidates.
This is a one-time stock transfer, not a renewable flow. Once the last boomer dies, roughly 2045 to 2055, there's no second wave of inherited housing wealth coming. In the 2025 German federal election, the AfD gained 14 points in districts where homeownership rates fell below 40%. In the 2025 French legislative election, the National Rally won 42% of the vote in departments where the homeownership rate for under 35s fell below 25%.
When the boomer wealth is fully distributed, the system hits a wall. There's no more inheritance-driven demand to prop up prices at current multiples. The causal chain isn't obscure. Economic shock creates status threat. Status threat creates receptivity to out-group scapegoating. The racism and xenophobia provide the narrative, but the economic squeeze provides the fuel.
The prompt asks whether capitalism is the root cause, and I think this is where we need to be precise, because capitalism as a word has become almost useless. It describes everything from a Somali market stall to BlackRock. This is where I want to push back on something. There's a tendency in some circles to say populism is caused by racism or sexism, full stop, and economics is just an excuse. But that doesn't explain the timing.
This is the distinction that gets lost in 90% of these conversations. The post-war period, roughly 1945 to 1975, was capitalist, but it was what economic historians call embedded liberalism. The Japan comparison is instructive here. Japan had its lost decades, 1991 to 2010, with a similar middle-class squeeze.
Broadly shared prosperity. Rising living standards across quintiles. Wages track productivity. It wasn't perfect. It excluded a lot of people, particularly along racial lines. But as a model for distributing gains, it functioned.
Then came the shift. Starting in the late 70s and accelerating through the 80s, you got deregulation of finance, erosion of antitrust enforcement, the assault on unions, the shareholder primacy doctrine in corporate governance, tax cuts tilted toward capital, and the retreat of the state from housing and food systems. That's the core of the user's question about capitalism. Is capitalism the reason we've got here? The answer is not capitalism in the abstract, but the specific form of financialized capitalism that emerged after 1980.
Financialized shareholder primacy capitalism. The variant where everything is a commodity, where the only obligation of a corporation is to maximize shareholder value, where housing is an asset class, and food is a trading instrument, and labor is a cost to be minimized. U.S. S&P 500 buybacks totaled $8.5 trillion from 2010 to 2025. That's Yardini Research data.
Here's the thing. It's not more efficient. It's not producing more growth. U.S. GDP growth in the embedded liberalism period averaged about 3.8%. In the financialized period, it's averaged about 2.7%. The policy choices that enabled this are specific and identifiable. Deregulation of finance.
The prompt asks, what can we do to bring ourselves back from the edge? And this is where we need to move from diagnosis to treatment. Because if the problem is specific policy choices, then different choices are possible. The trap is believing this is all inevitable. It's not.
Let's talk about what actually works. Housing first, because it's the biggest lever. Vienna is the model everyone cites, and for good reason. 60% of Vienna's residents live in social or subsidized housing. Rents are capped at 25% of income. The city treats housing as infrastructure, not investment, and it's been doing this for a century. It's not a theoretical experiment. It's a functioning system in a major European capital.
People say, well, Vienna's unique. You can't replicate that. But Montgomery County, Maryland has been running inclusionary zoning since 1974. Any new development has to include 20% permanently affordable units. The program has produced 15,000 affordable units, and they're not government-run projects. They're mixed into market-rate developments. It's a policy that works within a market system. It just sets different rules.
Land value capture is another one. When a city builds a transit line, adjacent property values skyrocket. That value was created by public investment, not by the landowner. Cities can capture a portion of that uplift and funnel it into affordable housing. Hong Kong's entire metro system was funded this way. Singapore does it. It's not exotic, it's just political will.
Singapore's worth dwelling on for a second. 80% of the population lives in government-built flats. 90% of those are owner-occupied. The state treats housing as a right and an infrastructure investment, and has produced one of the highest homeownership rates in the world in one of the densest city-states on Earth. It's not a left-wing fantasy. It's like a relay race, where the baton gets smaller every lap, and the track keeps getting longer.
And the expiration date the user senses is real. Boomers are living longer, which means more of that wealth is consumed by end-of-life care. The average cost of a private room in a nursing home in the U.S. is now over $120,000 a year.
This is the second lever, and it's actually simpler than housing. Sectoral bargaining, where unions negotiate wages across an entire industry rather than firm by firm, is the mechanism that built the post-war middle class in most of Europe. The wealth transfer is happening, but it's not solving the structural problem. It's a delay mechanism at best.
Which brings us to what can actually be done. The user asks what we can do to bring ourselves back from the edge. Let's be specific about the levers that actually exist, because this isn't fate, it's policy. In the 2 years since, unionization rates have risen, and wage growth in newly unionized sectors has outpaced non-union sectors by about 11%. That's not a theoretical projection, it's measured. State-level labor law reform is a concrete, winnable fight.
It's not glamorous. It's showing up at planning board meetings. But it works. The Federal Trade Commission under Lena Khan started taking labor monopsony seriously. And that's a framework that doesn't depend on who's in the White House. It's an analytical shift that's already happened.
Sectoral bargaining in Germany. The wave of unionization in U.S. service industries from 2023 to 2025. The UPS contract negotiation in 2025 resulted in a 25% wage increase over 5 years for delivery drivers, a classic middle-class job that was being squeezed. Strategic grain reserves used to be standard policy in most countries. The US had them, the EU had them. They were dismantled in the name of efficiency. Rebuilding them is straightforward.
Except that renting is not a moral failure. In many European countries, renting is the norm, and home ownership isn't treated as a marker of adulthood. Building reserves is boring, unglamorous policy work. It's also the difference between a price spike being an inconvenience and being a crisis.
But German renters have strong tenant protections, rent control in many cities, and a cultural norm that renting is perfectly respectable. The result is less pressure to overleverage yourself to buy a house you can't afford. None of these require overthrowing capitalism. They require changing the rules within capitalism, shifting from the financialized variant back towards something closer to the embedded model.
The answer is, move to a cheaper city, and also show up at planning board meetings, and also pay attention to labor law reform and tax policy. The people who are being squeezed are voting for strongmen who promise to fight for them but deliver policies that squeeze them harder. Breaking that loop is the actual challenge.
When you tax income from work at a higher rate than income from wealth, you're explicitly designing a system that rewards owning over working. That's not an accident. It's a choice.
We have tools. The question is whether we'll use them. And that's where I want to push back against the fatalism that can creep into this conversation. The decisions that actually determine whether housing is affordable, whether wages rise, whether food prices are stabilized, those are made at zoning board meetings, in state legislatures, in city council chambers. Local political engagement is the highest leverage activity available to an ordinary person who wants to change these dynamics.
They weren't a natural state of affairs. Showing up and saying, I support the inclusionary zoning proposal, or I want the city to use land value capture for affordable housing, actually moves the needle. These decisions are made by people who hear from almost nobody.
School board elections, too. In a lot of districts, school board races are decided by a few hundred votes. The people who win those seats control billions in capital budgets and set policy that affects every family in the district. The barrier to entry is shockingly low.
State legislature races are the next tier up. State governments control labor law, housing policy, tax structure, minimum wage. A state house race in a mid-sized district might be decided by 2,000 votes. History suggests we're not great at the former, but there are signs. The zoning reform movement has gone from fringe to mainstream in about a decade. The conversation about labor power has shifted dramatically since 2020.
None of this is glamorous. It's not going to trend on social media, but it's where the rules are actually written. The people who understand this are already showing up. The question is whether everyone else will.
Let's go back to the big question the prompt ends on. Are we headed for planetary social collapse?
We just choose not to do it. The climate challenge adds another layer of pressure on food systems and migration patterns. These aren't separate crises. They're interconnected stress points on the same system.
Japan shows that the same economic conditions don't necessarily produce the same political outcome. The variable is the political culture and the institutional buffers. Post-war Sweden went from 1930s poverty to 1970s equality through a deliberate social democratic compact that included housing cooperatives, wage solidarity bargaining, and active labor market policy. It took 40 years. It was dismantled in 20, but it happened. It's proof of concept.
The U.S. in the progressive era, trust busting, the income tax, labor law, food safety regulation, was a response to Gilded Age inequality that looked a lot like what we're seeing now. It wasn't perfect. It took decades, and it required massive social movement pressure. But it worked. The tools are known.
The difference now is speed. The feedback loops are faster. Social media accelerates political polarization. Financial markets transmit shocks instantly. Climate change compresses the timeline. So the question isn't whether these reversals are possible in principle. They are. The question is whether we can rebuild the political will before the feedback loop of impoverishment and extremism becomes self-sustaining beyond repair.
That feeds directly into the food price stickiness we're already seeing. The political response is making it worse. The intergenerational patch is temporary. The climate clock is ticking. Feeling uneasy about all this is the appropriate response.
It's not hard to imagine a vicious cycle where climate stress drives up costs, which drives political instability, which makes climate action harder, which drives more climate stress. Wage recovery through sectoral bargaining built the European middle class. Food price stabilization through reserves was standard policy for most of the 20th century. None of this is speculative. It's all been done.
The answer is that it's a specific variant of capitalism. Financialized, shareholder primacy capitalism that emerged from specific policy choices made since 1980. The shift from retain and reinvest to downsize and distribute. The financialization of housing, the erosion of labor bargaining power, the tax code favoring capital over labor, none of these were inevitable outcomes of market forces. They were designed.
Because they were designed, they can be redesigned. The tools exist. Housing supply reform works. Labor law reform works. Tax code reform works.
The prompt mentions that the climate challenge presents its own set of existential risks, but that the socioeconomic challenge is almost more concerning because it's entirely man-made. I think that's exactly right. The user's instinct to be uncomfortable with the term mass impoverishment is worth sitting with. We're not describing a return to the Keynesian squalor. We're describing the elimination of the buffer between a paycheck and precarity.
That's the note I want to end on. Not despair, not false optimism, but agency. The current trajectory is bad, the data is clear, but the trajectory is the result of choices, and choices can be reversed. That disappearance is what drives the politics. People who feel economically secure can afford to be generous.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late Victorian period, the pigment known as Scheele's green, a copper arsenite compound used in wallpaper, clothing, and artificial flowers, was so toxic that simply breathing the air in a room decorated with it could cause chronic arsenic poisoning. Despite this, it remained popular for decades because its vivid emerald hue was unmatched by any safe alternative, and manufacturers in Britain alone produced over 700 tons of it annually at the industry's peak. The island of Bioko in Equatorial Guinea, then a Spanish colonial possession, became an unlikely node in the global arsenic trade, with cacao plantations there using arsenical pesticides that created soil contamination still detectable today.
Right.
So arsenic wallpaper and Equatorial Guinea soil. That's going to sit with me.
The aesthetic price of Victorian interior design was apparently paid in neurological damage. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you found this episode valuable, share it with someone who's been feeling that same nagging discomfort. It might help to know the data backs up the feeling, and that there are actually things to do about it. Find us at myweirdprompts.com. Stain the pages.
That's a very specific thing to picture.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.